Good morning. Who's on the line?
Morning.
Good morning.
How's it going there? Is it Jim and Josh?
Josh and Jim here so far.
All right. How's everybody going?
Doing pretty good.
Getting used to the Arizona heat?
Yeah, getting used to it, I guess.
It's going to be over 100 for the next week. Yeah, sure it's going to get hotter.
Yeah.
Good morning, it's Cal and Doug.
Hey, you guys, how are you?
Good. When are you heading down to Phoenix?
Going on Tuesday evening, about 7 o'clock, I think, is the flight.
Okay, we're leaving Wednesday morning.
Oh, you're going to be there, too?
Yeah, we're going to be there Wednesday, Thursday, and heading back late afternoon on Friday.
Oh, I know. It's supposed to be nice. You and Doug and Josh will be there. That's really, I had no idea you guys were going to be there.
Yep.
I look forward to it. It'd be nice. Bring some extra Freon. I'm just going to have it on the ice. I mean, have it on the rocks.
Are you staying through Shabbat?
Yeah, I'm staying for a full week.
Okay. So does that mean we won't be having class here on Sunday next week then?
As of now, I think we should hold off. I'm not sure how I'm going to be set up over there or what the plans are going to be, so I would hold off.
Okay.
Next Sunday. Although I was thinking, I mean, I'm going to take my laptop and I'll be able to, you know, call in. So I was thinking maybe during the week, who knows? But, you know, I'll send an email out if, you know, because I'm going to have a lot of downtime, so I'd like to use it to do some studying and, you know, come up with some interesting things. We'll see if it's good for your schedules. We could, you know, share it a bit online or go on the phone or something. So we'll play it by ear.
Okay. We're hoping to get in on some classes while we're down there if Rabbi Mann is teaching anything.
Well, I'm sure there'll be plenty of, I don't know, classes, but I mean, I'm sure there'll be, I don't know what his schedule is in terms of if he does classes at the shul, you know, those days of the week. Maybe it's just morning, but I'm sure that there'll be get-togethers, and there'll be, you know, Rosenthal's will be there, or Saul Zucker's going to be there, so I'm sure the conversations will be, you know, jam-packed and long.
Yeah.
It'll be nice. Okay, so we're going further now. We already finished up the Ibn Ezra. Very, very, very important Ibn Ezra. And if you can get a hold of the English, I'm not sure if there is one on Kahelis, but you get to do. And Laura, hi, I see you're online from Washington. Good to see you today. But yeah, the Ibn Ezra is really good. So, or again, and I'll have to, I was remiss, I didn't put the last Sunday's class online. I'll do that after today's class along with today's. So this way, you know, if you want to review all three, you'll have it there. Okay, so we're up to 7-4. Unless there are any questions, this is a wrap-up from, you know, the last 3 weeks. Okay. All right, so the next verse seems relatively easy and a little bit of a repetition. Tell me if this sounds familiar and we heard it before. 7-4 in Kohelis, we're moving forward now. The heart of the wise people is in the house of mourning, and the heart of fools is in the house of partying.
We already have that verse.
Sounds like it, right?
It does.
All right, 7-2, take a look.
Yeah.
7-2 says it's better to go to the house of mourning than it is to go to the house of a party, of drinking and eating. But now this is where, you know, the analytical skills come in, and you have to compare and look for the deviant, you know, where the, you know, one verse deviates from the other.
Well, in this case, it's talking about the heart of the wise, not the actual action of going.
Good. Okay, what else?
Doesn't go into the part about, for this is the end of every man, and the living shall lay it to his heart. Just as talking about where the heart of the wise puts its focus as opposed to the heart of the fool.
Right. So perhaps that's not necessary. And that's where he leaves it out. Then we have to explain why it's not necessary.
Verse 2, it's a house of feasting. Verse 4, it's a house of joy.
Right.
At least translation.
Right. That another difference is that the first one, in 7:2, it says it's better to go to the house of mourning than it is to go to the house of partying and feasting. But the feasting is replaced with gladness, if you look at 7:4. Yet it doesn't use the same word. Alright, so you see that difference, right? In Hebrew, it's mishteh, which means drinking and eating. Usually means drinking. And simcha means the state of the heart, not the act of drinking, but joy. So why is he making that distinction? And again, just in general, like Dougie said, that it seems to be in general, it's a repeated concept. It's true there's some differences, but does that warrant almost an exact replication of verse 7:2? So it must be, in general, it must be something new. Because it is. Go ahead.
I would presume that the emphasis is not then on the actions, but where you put your focus even when you're not there.
All right, you just basically gave over Ibn Ezra's commentary. That's exactly what Ibn Ezra says.
And I have to, by full rights, tell you that I have Ibn Ezra in front of me.
You do? You have the English Ibn Ezra?
Well, the Judaica publishing house, or Judaica press version of Ecclesiastes, has a compendium. So it doesn't always give every commentator on every verse. But they happen to give a short summary of Ibn Ezra here.
Good. That's exactly good. So you're an honest plagiarizer. I like that.
I cannot take credit for the Ibn Ezra's ideas.
Yes, that's right. What does Ibn Ezra say? He says, the house of, the heart of the wise man is in the house of mourning. What does he say? He says, after he already mentioned in verse 7:2 that it's better to go to the house of mourning. So he says, now that the wise men's heart, even when they're not going to the house of mourning, nonetheless, their hearts are there. Okay, so, and you see also that it does say, at the end of verse 2, that the living should place this on their heart. I mean, he gives instruction. Verse 2 actually hints to verse 4, because he's saying that. And we also said, remember, I think an important but subtle idea that we mentioned on 7:2 is that we asked, why does it say it's better to go to the house of mourning? Why does it say it's better to go to the house of drinking? Right? From, you know, it's not better, that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of drinking. Meaning to go. We're asking a question, why don't you just say it's better to be there? So we said to go means to say that the person is on a path and he's looking at where life will take him, what's the next step, like the Pirkei Avos says, that who's a wise man, who's a wise person? One who looks at the results of his actions. He looks at the outcome. And you see, he says that in 7:2. He says, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, on account of, this is the end of man. I mean, the person who's living properly is not living in the moment. He is taking in the entire spectrum of life, the entire existence of man. And he makes his judgments and value assessments based on that.
Brother?
Yes.
I was curious as to why the wise go to the house of mourning and not like the house of study. Like, wouldn't education be a, I don't know. Or is this just talking about a certain, I don't know.
Is that Cal?
No, it's Francesca.
Francesca, hi. Good morning, this is Rivka. I have something written, Rabbi. Could I read it?
Sure.
Tanakh, may I answer her?
Yes.
Francesca, it says here in the Tanakh, yes, it's in English, eulogies, at, you know, in other words, at the house of mourning, eulogies will stimulate one to think about the beauty of life and inspire one to repent and realize that only a good reputation has lasting value. So that's what it accomplishes. Of course, learning is very important, but for going and hearing the eulogies, that could accomplish, you know, thoughtfulness on one's part.
Thank you.
Okay.
I hear you saying, I don't think that answers Francesca's question, though. What is it specifically?
It doesn't. It's just commenting on the fact that it's going to, you'll just, because learning is always the best thing to do, and I'm wondering also the same thing, but so I brought this out to add myself to Francesca's question. Okay. Why, you know, would it be better to sit and learn than to go? For instance, we're learning this morning. If there was an opportunity to go to a house of mourning, should we have gone to the house of mourning or to stay and learn in the class?
No, learning. Learning is the greatest.
I have also.
Learning is the greatest command. So, but there are mitzvahs that, for example, you can't. Even though learning is the greatest mitzvah, and the Gemara, the Talmud actually says that if you have two mitzvahs in front of you, so you let somebody else do the lesser and you take the greater, unless it's impossible that nobody else will address it. So then you have to take the one that comes to you first. So if somebody needs a small favor and you're in the middle of learning, but nobody else can do it, then you'd have to address that. So there's a reason behind that. But in terms of, or like certain commands, like putting on tefillin or things of that nature that you have to do yourself, it's not something where it's the activity that has to be done, but it's you as the person required. So then a person can give the argument, well, I'm learning, I'm exempt from putting on tefillin, I'm learning, I'm exempt from the time for prayer, because there the person is forfeiting something which only he can do and he must do. That's already part of the system, that those things are essential to his perfection. So he can't forego that. It's only when something is not specifically incumbent upon him that he takes the greater command and he does the lesser one. So in terms of going to the house of mourning, he'd have to do that too, because that's for his own perfection. It's not something which is just an activity that has to be done, like helping somebody across the street. I don't have to do that. Somebody else can do it. It's the act which has to be addressed. So if there's nobody else around, I would have to stop. But if there is somebody else around, you let somebody else do that, and you stay with the learning. But now the question is, why does King Solomon say over here that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to house of party? Why does he say it's better to go to the house of study than to go to the house of party? So the answer is because here he is discussing a specific concept of a person's view of mortality. So to address that, you have to show both sides of the coin. So that's specifically, like, for example, if you give another example. You could say it's better for a person to be more charitable than he is to be a miser. So why don't you just say it's better for a person to go to the house of study than to be a miser? Because that's not the topic. The topic there is in terms of the relationship to money. So then you show from two extremes which one is better. Which one is going to be more perfecting? So here we're not talking about money. Here we're talking about where a person is looking at his mortality. So there you're talking about whether the person is going to just invest his time in partying, because the underpinning of that motivation is that he's here and he's not leaving. So therefore, that's a denial of reality. That's why he says it's better, and this is answering your question, Francesca, that Rivka, that it's better because it's there's truth involved when you go to the house of mourning. Then you're not denying the entire spectrum of human existence. The person who just goes to the party is involved in a certain denial. So he's got the option. Of course, you have to make people happy. You have to be happy yourself. It's not saying never to go to a party. Okay, but since he's talking about mortality over here, so you see earlier, he said in the first verse, he said it's better as a good name than oil, and better as a day of death than a day of birth. So you see, he starts off the theme, talking about mortality, the span of life. So therefore, within that conversation, it's not appropriate to talk about that learning is better. That's a different point. All right? Here we're talking about mortality, so therefore we refer to the two extremes.
Okay.
Within the mortality.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Now let's go back, unless there's any other questions.
Yes, you know what, Rabbi, in reference to this again, before we leave it, if a person he's obliged to pray a certain time every day, so if he has the opportunity to go to a house of mourning, his obligation is to pray first, then go, not to just go, is that correct?
Right, because he can still go to the mourning house later on that day.
Right, okay, fine, that's it.
Whichever one he could do. Okay. If there's one that's quickly expiring, he doesn't want to lose that. The objective is to, if he has both obligations, to do both obligations.
Uh-huh.
But if one is expiring, let him do that one first, and then let him do the second one. If he can't do both, then you have to choose which is the greater one.
Right. Okay. Very good.
That's
Thank you.
That's why it's important to study the commands and to know how to discern which is better, attending a house of mourning or prayer. That's a good question.
Right. Okay.
So it absolutely makes. There's actually a Talmud. It's in I think it's Moed Katan, and it talks about the students of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai who were equating the different commands, the different mitzvos, and they were trying to determine which is better, which is more value. So you see that was an important thing. It's an important thing to be able to determine the which commands are of greater importance or which are lesser. Okay. So he says over here, so again, we said that, why does it say going to the house of mourning is better than going to the house of party? So we mentioned going again, just to make it clear, is that because he's trying to subtly bring out that concept that you're always you're always moving. There's a continuum that we're all on. We're not in a static moment. Time is constantly flowing. So what's going to happen next? What's going to be the future? So the wise person looks at the end of the actions. He looks at the whole spectrum of life, where he's going to. That's why he can make the better decision. Okay. And that's why it says at the end of that verse, for that is the end of man. Meaning since man's existence it doesn't end with being on earth, but it continues another state, and that's the perfection of the soul. So that's why the person ponders and he goes to the house of mourning to remind himself of that very concept. And therefore that tempers his energies and where he's going to place importance. Where do I put my energies today? Is it something which is fleeting, which is useless, that has no effect whatsoever on my long... May the eternity of my soul? Is it going to damage my soul? So these considerations weigh heavy. Sforno actually says on this, he says as follows. He says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. He says that the he says on this, there gives evidence to the trial that a person has. Because the wise men, they grieve over what they're lacking, and it bothers them, right? They're very bothered by it. They worry about the future, the day that is going to visit them, the day of death, maybe. So therefore, they strive to acquire completion of their soul, or an internal completion. What he means to say is that they realize where they're going. This is temporary here, so they don't want to put energies into something which is detracting from the perfection of the soul. At the same time, you know, a person who's wise understands that he needs an equilibrium. A person has to be in a good state. His mind has to be content. So that will require at times that he has release, that he has, he sees friends, and he enjoys the holidays like God commands us to eat meat and to drink wine and to enjoy. But his mind is never off the end. But it's not morbid. It's not a morbid picture that they're painting here. It's a picture of reality that the person understands that this is this is not the whole existence of man. And when a person has it clear, he's constantly thinking about that. How can I invest more in terms of my eternal life? And then Sforno goes on and he says, but the heart of the fools is in the house of joy. Because what do? They just gladden themselves on the physical pleasures, which is now alone without even looking at the future. Right, so temporal. They're looking for the temporal. But that's because their focus, their assessment of life is really the immediate. What's going to give me the gratification, the pleasure, the sensory pleasures? Right, Rashi also says that the fools don't tremble from the day of death. But he says that the heart of the wise men, they're thinking about it. That's something we should think about. It does not mean the mortal. It means when it says that they're thinking about the day of death, it means they don't deny it like the rest of the world does. So having that conviction that this life does come to a halt, but that the soul can exist in a state that's even better, and that it continues, so they're interested in what's going to benefit me in an eternal framework as opposed to just a momentary framework. So to them, I mean, you can't compare an eternal existence of the soul to a few decades on Earth. And it takes time, it takes training, but the clearer we have an idea, the more readily we can act upon it and be consistent and not deny it. Because you know, the emotions are always there until the day of death, and we have to battle them. But as ideas become clearer, so then the emotion has less power because the mind has the ability to be convinced over something. The emotions are just satisfying. But God designed us in a way where the intelligence has the upper hand if we train it. Because seeing reality with the mind has a greater ability to move us to action than just chasing after some temporary satisfaction. That's because God, it would be wrong, it would be cruel if God would make us in a way, tell us to follow the good, but the emotions were stronger than the intelligence. That can't be just. So it must be that he tells us to follow the good because we have the ability to follow the good and we can squelch the emotions. But that's only going to come through the realization. And you see here that the person who places it on his heart, like he says at the end of 7:2, so then it's constantly on his mind. But he's happy. He looks forward to it. The Rambam, Maimonides talks about how the wise men, they anticipated the next world. They saw it would be a situation where they could be involved in wisdom without any type of tire, of hunger, of any type of distraction. All the physical issues that we have to deal with in the physical life are not going to be impediments once the physical is gone. So they anticipated that state because they came to such a joy of wisdom, of learning. And they just, when they saw new concepts, it was like a light going off in their head. It was something remarkable, and they thirsted for that in an undistracted, undisturbed state. And that's what the that's what the future world, you know, holds for a person who's living righteously, intelligently, and he has the right concepts. Okay. He then goes on. Now we could also, about the discrepancy. We said in verse 2 that, and Jim picked up on that, that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of drinking. But in 4 it says to the house of joy. It doesn't say the house of drinking. So why does he change it? So, if you look at verse 2, so what is it talking about? And Doug, you said this. That's the practical, when he's actually there, when he's actually going. So 2 is the practical. What is 4? How would you categorize verse 4?
Verse 4 is more about your philosophical view of life, or where you're focusing your mental attention.
Right, exactly. So that being the case, it's not the practical, so then you can't talk about a practical act of drinking. You're talking about the attitude. So that's really what the drinking is really targeting. So when he talks about the practice, there he talks about the act of drinking. That's what the fools want to do. But inside, what they're really drinking for is because they want to reach a state of joy. So that's why when he talks about the attitude in 4, so therefore he switches it. But there is no difference, though, in terms of the wise men. The house of mourning, that's the same in both. Why is that?
Well, the idea of the house of mourning is synonymous with the idea behind it.
Which is good, because that shows you that there's no difference, like in an act which is corrupt. So then there's a fantasy and then there's the act. They're two different things. Like the person drinks, but there he's doing the act because he's trying to target a fantasy. So he's actually not even doing what he wants. There's a disconnect. Whereas in something which is reality, so it's constant. Meaning this is the, when I go, when I'm involved in reality, so that means what is real. So real traverses, you know, practice and the attitude of the person in his mind. Reality means that it is one. There's no disconnect between the person's practice and his philosophy. Whereas a person who's living, he's going after the physical, so it's not even the physical that he really wants. He's looking at the physical. He's taking the physical, but he's trying to get something else. And that's what the whole the commencement that Rabbi Shade explained. The futility of futilities. He started off the book, King Solomon, Kohelis. So if you remember, we said Rabbi Shade's explanation, really beautiful idea, that what's the futility of a futility? So Rabbi Chait said that one futility is that the person is just going after the physical, and that's not something which benefits his soul. Another futility is that he fantasizes about it. And that also is not something which helps him. But you see, that's something which exists in when one pursues that which is not good, or the physical. So he attaches fantasy to it. Because the object per se, evidently, doesn't really have the satisfaction. So there's fantasy that he makes up about it. The person would be realistic. He's going on a trip. And he thought thought about all the things that can go wrong in terms of weather and losing the luggage and flights being canceled or delayed and being stuck at the airport. They really looked at that. They really would not be interested in taking as many trips as he does. But what he does is he creates a fantasy that's pristine. It's flawless. No clouds. Everything is on time. Comfortable seats. There's no babies crying next to me in the plane. And the person has to do that because reality, in truth, doesn't offer that. But when you're talking about something which is realistic, it's consistent. So thinking about the house of mourning or being there is the same idea. So perhaps that's why there's no change when it comes to the practice of reality and your attitude towards it. It's consistent.
Wait, Rabbi?
Yeah.
I'm confused. So somebody, suppose after something physical, you're saying that there's a disconnect because they have this idea about something, a certain expectation, and then when they do it, it doesn't meet in reality? That's the disconnect?
Yes. I think you even said it better than me.
But in the first, they're saying an example was drinking, though, that they fantasize about drinking, and then when they do it, it's not really as enjoyable as they thought.
Well, we're looking at the verses and we're comparing. Why is it, when it comes to the practice, it talks about going to a house of drinking? When you talk about the thought, it's not about the drinking. Now he changes it to joy, the attitude of the just being happy. Why does he have to change it when he's talking about the person's thoughts? Why does he change it? So we're suggesting that when a person's practicing something which is one thing he's going after, the physical act, what he's targeting is not even the physical act. It's like he thinks it's going to get him somewhere, and that's the joy. I mean, he really goes through the act of drinking. He wants to now get to a certain state of being where he's happy. Just putting liquid in his mouth is not the be-all and end-all. He wants to have a state where he's removed of conflict. So, there's a difference.
So he sacrificed that he'll be so happy when he's drinking this drink, and then when he does, it doesn't meet up to his fantasy?
No, it won't. It won't meet up, but what we're saying is not exactly that point. It's a little bit off that point. It's that when he says that it's, in terms of the practice of a person, he's better off not going to the house of drinking. And we're comparing that to, or not the practice, but the verse 7:4, where he says he's better off not having his heart in the house of joy. So why does he change the word from drinking to joy? Because in both cases, when he talks about the practice, he says it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of drinking. Then when he talks about not the practice, not the going, but it's better off to where's your heart, meaning where are your thoughts? It's better off to have your thoughts in the house of mourning, so that is identical. But then he changes it and he says it's better to do that, to have your thoughts in the house of mourning than to have your thoughts in the house of joy. Why didn't he say to have your thoughts in the house of drinking? So we're saying when it comes to thinking, meaning what state the mind, what's the state of the mind the person's trying to get to? Just to...
That makes sense, thank you.
Yeah, it's not, just to say more, is that it's not, when a person's, where's his heart? Where's a person's heart right now? Is he thinking about the drinking, or the thought is not commensurate with the physical drinking? That's a frustrated thing. But he wants to reach the attitude of thought. So in his thinking, so that has to be commensurate. I'll have to think about it and see if I can flesh this out a little bit better.
No, it sounds like the second verse is we're talking about somebody's outlook, and then the first verse is the practice. Person's
right.
Their practice, I guess.
Right.
For on their practice, and then the second one's like their philosophy.
Right. So the person who's perfected, his practice and his philosophy are identical. He realizes that man is temporary. That's what it means, the house of mourning. He realizes that life is temporary, so that's a reality. There's no difference in practice and his thought. But in terms of a person who's chasing after the physical, so in practice he does certain things, but in terms of the attitude that he has, so he's trying to, it's not the drinking as the end, that he's trying to get to a state of joy. He's really, he just wants to be happy in the moment. He wants to have like be in a state of mind of partying. But it's really the state of mind that he wants. Let me see if I can think of that, if I can try to say it better. I see that it's not as clear as it could be.
Okay.
Give me 1 second. Let me see.
I might add that one of the problems with going down the road of drinking is that, yeah, you can get into a state where you feel like you have no conflicts. The state is only temporary, and as soon as the alcohol wears off, all the conflicts are still there.
Yeah, true, Dad.
I gotta think about this. You were saying it's true, Doug. Well, let me look it over. Of course, there's not too many commentators on this one point. Let's see, we covered Rashi. All right, let's do one more verse, and then I'll think about verse 4. Okay, verse 5. It's better to hear the shouts of a wise man, the rebuke of a wise man, rather than a man who hears the songs of fools. So what does Ibn Ezra say on this? He says that it's better off for a person who is not a wise man that he should hear the rebuke of a wise man more than it'll help him, right? Because those words will help him, the words of wisdom. And it'll benefit his soul than hearing songs of the fools. Okay, that's Ibn Ezra. And the Sforno says, he starts off his commentary by saying, therefore, meaning based on verse 4, right, since it's better that your heart should be in the house of mourning than it should be in the house of joy, therefore, it's better to hear the rebuke of a wise man. Because even though this is going to grieve a person, it's going to pain him to hear that he's wrong about something when a wise man rebukes him, he will reach a perfection of something crooked in his personality. And this is better than hearing, than a man hearing the song of fools, even though that it gladdens him temporarily. So he's continuing on the theme. So what is he adding? And the Sforno, again, is saying is a connection. Since 4 is true, therefore 5 is true. So what's the equation? Since it's better off that my heart should be pondering my mortality, then I should be, thinking about going to a great party. Therefore, it's better to hear the rebuke of a wise man than to be a man that hears the song of the fools. I mean, something which is very pleasant.
Getting at the point that the rebuke of a wise person is going to, and again, I'm looking at Ibn Ezra too, it's going to do more for you in terms of the perfection of your soul than just, you know, listening to something that seems pleasant to your ears.
Okay, but what's his, it sounds like it's a repetition of the previous verse. What's the new point? What does it bring out of here? What are the new words, perhaps, that we have not seen yet in Qoheles?
The new word here is rebuke, and it seems to me that this is getting more to reflecting on a person's character rather than just reflecting the character in the here and now rather than reflecting on the day of death.
So it means more of a short-range step.
Right, and what I can do right now in the present, okay. Seeing this as an opportunity.
Okay, good. So, first of all, you're right. In terms of the previous verse, 4, that was talking about an overall philosophy that I carry with me internally. That where is my mind's eye? But then there's the individual applications of that on a step-by-step basis. For example, it's better off if you had the choice to get the counsel and rebuke of a wise person than to just... to enjoy the serenity, the joy of the singing of people that are just involved in music, which he calls fools. So that's one thing. But he says here, also it's better to listen to the rebuke, the person shouting at you. And he compares that to other people that are singing. But it's interesting also, he adds in the word ish, man. You see that? He doesn't have that in the beginning of the verse. He says in the beginning, it's just better to listen to the rebuke of a wise person than to be a man that listens to the song of fools. Why is it to throw man in? I mean, aren't we talking about a human being already? It's understood. It's better that, you have to tell me that it's better for you to be a human being or a man that listens to the rebuke of a wise man. We know that you're a man. What is that word man doing there? Do you see that? And it doesn't say Adam. There's different words for man. So you have to know how ish is used. Ish refers to status, like a man of war, or a man of this type of industry. Adam just means that he's created, refers to the fact that he's created, because Adam refers to Adama, the root of that is earth. Man is made from earth, so that's a different connotation. But here it says, Better to listen. Doesn't talk about you being a man in this case. All right? But it's talking about, again, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to be a man who listens to the song of fools. So, there's something else here also. There's two ideas I want to bring out. One, like Cal said, that this is now showing the application of, since the soul should be the primary focus, so that's, therefore, the wise person's heart is always, he contemplates the idea of his mortality. His heart is in the house of mourning. It's not in the house of joy, because joy is temporary. And since that's so, he is better off listening to the rebuke of the wise, because the rebuke of the wise people, of a wise person, is going to help you perfect your soul, which is targeting the real goal. That you have, that you're involved in the real good, and that you are investing in your eternity. But what also comes out from this is that, why isn't it just saying in the verse, it's better to heed to ideas that perfect your soul? Why does it have to bring in the point that there's a man yelling at me, or there's a man singing to me? You see the question? It could have just said, it's better off. I mean, you didn't bring a man into verse 4. It was just my own contemplation. My contemplation is better off being in the house of mourning than in the house of, my heart should not be in the house of joy. So why in this case now he brings in man? And this, I think, lands also why it has the word ish. Because when you bring in other people, now it's throwing you into the realm of the social. And what is the underlying message over here, one of them, is that King Solomon is saying, ignore the desire for social status, for social accolades. That will be a problem in terms of perfecting your soul. You're going to be concerned about how you're going to look. Your self-image is better off. Let the man yell at you. And you're not. Don't be a man in that case. He doesn't use the word man. He just is better to listen to the shouting, to the cry of a wise man. When he's basically rebuking, that is better for you than to be a man who listens to the song. Oh, you see what he's saying? When you listen to songs, people singing to you, people praising to you, or people involved. So that's building up your own social status, or your enjoyment in terms of your feeling of yourself. And he's saying that's something you have to forego. It's important that a person sensitive to, is this now, am I caving it a bit to my ego? Am I doing this act because it's going to give me a certain amount of ego? That's not good. Like Maimonides says, that's one of the two traits that we go to the other extreme. We don't try to find the middle ground. Ego and anger, those two we have to go to the other extreme and not give in to them at all. So you see here, it's better that you should lower yourself, and you're not even a man at all. Let the wise man yell at you. Let him put you down. Let him show you your flaws. Meaning, completely remove any attempt for ego. This is not what your goal is. Listen to the person. Let him size you up, rebuke you, and give you a real critique. And don't be defensive. That will be better for you than to try to seek the songs of other people. That's why it brings people into this verse. Because now he's showing you that there's going to be an element on the path to perfection. There's going to be that element of wanting to have a sustained self-image with everybody else. But if you are going for the self-image, then you're foregoing your real perfection. You have to be humble. The self can't be there. So you see how cleverly King Solomon does not say it's better for a man to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. No, the man, the self-image is not there at all in that first part of the verse. It's just better that you are completely transparent. You're not even there in the verse. Listen to the rebuke of the wise man, rather than being a man who listens to the song of fools. Because there, you're living in the moment. It's something which is very pleasing and is happy for you, because now you become the focus, and it's not the perfection of your soul. Okay, everybody see those two ideas? You see how subtly he works. But when you are forced to detect such subtle differences, that's where the mind can really achieve a great new step in terms of becoming sharper and more sensitive to even something like a subtle clue.
Rabbi, it's not clear to me why those ideas are pulled just out of the second reference to man and why they wouldn't be there even if that word wasn't there.
Because in the first area, the first part of the verse, what does he say? He says, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. Okay. You are not mentioned in that part of the verse at all, are you? You're reading it. You're listening to King Solomon. And he says, it's better to listen. So you're not even mentioned there. So why then does he have to mention that rather than being a man who listens to the song of fools? Why does he have to throw in than being a man who listens to this? He could just say again, just like he says, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to the song of fools. Why do you have to tell me that it's better than that than being a man who listens to the song of fools? What are we gaining? We should first have to see that there is an additional word there, right? That's not necessary. I mean, is that
right?
So if it's not, really, you can read the verse without it, so it must be adding something. And the word ish, as I'm telling you, means to say an image, the person's self-image. Like we said, the ish milchama, a man of war, means the image of man. And that's the Rebbe Chaik gave a beautiful class once on the wrestling of Jacob and the man. It doesn't say angel. It says he wrestled with a man. As Rabbi Shade explained, in the same verse it says that Jacob was left alone. He was up in the middle of the night preparing because Esav, his brother, was coming. And he feared the worst. He's going to try to kill him. So he was separating his family into two camps. So one got smitten. The other one would at least escape. He could save half the people. And so he separated. Then he went back across the river where he was alone. And then he wrestled with a man. Now, how could you be alone and also wrestle with a man? So his first step was to show, therefore, it can't be literal man. If he was alone, that means what he was wrestling was with some part of his personality. But man, meaning to say there was some self-image that was being brought, that was being awakened in his personality. Why was the self-image being awakened? Because as Esav approached, Esav was a big warrior. That was his whole, all he was a self-image. He had no perfection. But Jacob, upon the threat of the onslaught of his brother, he identified an element of that in his own personality. And he realized that has to be conquered. That's why he wrestled with the man. He wrestled with the man part of his personality. He saw that that's not a good thing in terms of my perfection, that I try to hold myself up with a certain self-image. That's going to be a cause for me to look aside from my flaws. If I'm trying to satisfy a self-image, that means I'm going to ignore things that are detrimental to my soul. So he wrestled with that part of his personality. Here the same word is used. The word ish, indicating that when a person's looking for the pleasing music as opposed to the rebuke, there's an element of his personality, of his ego, that's looking for satisfaction, and that can be hurtful to him. Because at the same time that you're trying to support and solidify your feelings of ego and your self-image, you have to, by definition, ignore things that are detrimental to your self-image. So that's why I'm suggesting that King Solomon throws in the word ish, man, when he talks about where a person just opting for music and for song to feel good about the self. I mean, what did the Ahasuerus in the story of Purim? He wanted to show off all of his grandeur. He invited all the important people there, but that was all an embellishment of his own ego. Look how much money I have. Look at the wine that I'm giving you. It says that he gave wine to each person that was older than every individual. That was to impress them. Look at what my money can buy. So involvement and happiness, there comes with it a certain amount of ego. The happiness also, you have to think about this. If you realize at certain times in life when you're happy, didn't it include a certain amount of a momentary reflection on where I am at in life? you had a promotion, you had a success, whatever it was, part of the happiness was now the reflection on the self, where I now got to, where I am. Taking yourself into account for a moment, and it felt good.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Could I ask to just step back to the part about Yaakov when he was fighting with the man? What was that, like his evil incarnation? Was that his ego? What was that that he was fighting with? It was a part of his personality, but which part can we say he was fighting with? Because it had to do with Esav.
Yeah, like I said,
it was anger, inner anger at Esav?
No,
no. Fear? No? What was it?
As I said, the Rebbe Chaim mentioned that he saw a certain part of his personality that Esav awakened in him, and Esav was basically a warrior, a person who was into his self-image. So Jacob saw that he had some taint of that too. I mean, every human being has that until they rid themselves of it by working on it. But that's why it woke that up in Jacob. He saw it himself because he didn't contemplate that until just now, because it didn't get, it wasn't really in the foreground. Nothing was there. There was no external stimulus to think about it. But when he saw Esav approaching him, and he looked at his stature, and he thought about his whole life as just being a warrior, he said, you know, I think I identify, I have some of that in myself too. So that's what he worked on getting rid of. The need for that type of an image of a man, of a conqueror, or successful, that was not something which he saw as being beneficial on his path towards perfection. So that's what it means. He was
okay. Thank you.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
So for the last few classes, we kind of talked about the development of the person when they start out instinctual, and that you combine your ego with your intellect to overcome the instinct. I was just curious, so we're looking at these verses and King Solomon's advising us. I'm wondering, like, would this advice work? I mean, is there some advice that's just not appropriate for people who aren't on a certain level to appreciate and maybe utilize that information? You know, I don't know if I have my question well developed.
You're asking if certain ideas a person's not ready to hear or to apply?
I guess both. Like, so we say at the end that you should listen to a wise man who rebukes you rather than listen to the song of fools. But if you haven't, like, say you are a fool, and would it be still, like, would it be worth your time to tell him that, or, I don't know.
You're right. I mean, King Solomon does address that. He talks about, he says in one case, I think it was one of the words, one of the cases that he gave us. He says, don't respond to a fool. And another case says, respond to a fool. Let me see if where that was exactly in here. Yeah, it's the very last line, at least in my edition here, where he says, you'll see something written in this sefer, in this book, and the second time he says just the opposite. He says, you also find in this book of Mishlei, where he says, do not answer the fool. And then he says in another verse, answer the fool. And you find this also in the prophets too. And even the Torah of our God, which is really the essence. In one case it says, there will not be a poor man among you. In another place it says, there will never cease to be a poor man. So that's how we ended off, at the very end of the commentary of Ibn Ezra that we did these past 3 weeks. But he quotes Mishlei, And he says in there, don't answer the fool. Another case says answer the fool. So it depends on the situation, to answer your question. There are times when, but that's talking about from the perspective of the intelligent person, whether or not he should respond to a foolish person or not. And that's, we'll have to see the verses to see what it says there in Mishnah. Maybe we'll do that in the next class. But yeah, there's definitely, like he said in Kohelis, I mean, he says here, we did it in chapter 3, it's a time, you know, time and place for everything. So sometimes, perhaps, it's not the right time for a certain idea to be given to a person. And Maimonides says this too. He says that, he writes a letter to a student where, in the beginning, I believe, in the Guides for Perplexed, Rabbi Chaitin highlighted this point, that he says that I did not give you certain answers because I wanted you to reach the answers or these ideas at the appropriate time. So you're correct, Francesca, that there is a time when something will be helpful and a time when it won't be.
Okay.
That makes sense, because a person has to be, you know, you see them from a child until they grow up, so they're not even involved in ego at a certain age, and then they get involved in that. It becomes a very big thing, you know, the teenage. So to talk about ego and things of that nature to a child, it wouldn't even register. So I think that analogy would apply to other things as well, other matters as well. But I think it is interesting, again, just to, I want to underline this point, that in verse 5, you see that he brings out, it's not just, he could have written and said it's better to contemplate, you know, the ideas, you know, truths, than to just listen to songs, listen to musical instruments. But he doesn't say that. He brings people into the picture. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to the song of fools, because he's trying to show you how the social element is going to play on a person's decisions. And he tells you here very subtly, but very clearly, that do not be concerned with the self if you're really interested in perfection. So the self, you have to be like, you're not there. Just take yourself out of the equation and listen to the ideas and see if they make sense to you. Are they good critiques of your own personality, of your own values? That's much more important than to be a man who listens to the song, meaning to look for the satisfaction of the self, to be a man that listens to the song of fools, to value the social arena, and to look at the self as having some sort of a satisfaction where I'm at. That's something that can be very damaging. That's why the king has, as a command in the Torah, one of the 613, that the king must carry a Torah with him everywhere he goes, lest his heart become very haughty over his brothers, the Torah says.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I think, too, another point with all of this is that, you know, when we think of the word rebuke, it's kind of hard, or it is in the category of a negative. And feasting and joy and all of these things, it would be easy to just put it in the category of a positive. And yet, examining these things help you realize that even though something may be hard to look at, it actually reaps greater reward.
All right, and what else does it tell you that he puts it in the negative? He tells you, don't do this, don't do that.
I'm not sure I follow your question.
Well, you brought out an important element here, that he's saying that He's vocalizing these lessons as don't do this, right? And don't do that. Because he's showing you that the proclivity of man is to do these things. That that we are initially geared in the way where we are looking for the emotional gratification. So we always have to be on guard, because that's how we started off. That's what it says in the Parsha of Noah, where it says that the evil inclination is in man from youth. There's the head start that the instincts have over the intelligence. So we're much more rooted and familiar and comfortable with emotional and sensual gratification. We've been doing that for so much longer. And it feels so real. And like we said in Ibn Ezra, it's something which is in our body. And the body is what a person looks at as being his sense of reality, not the mind. That's how initially we were designed. We can rise above that. So there's so much we have to fight against, only because we're used to it, and we started out that way. So that's why many lessons are restrictive, meaning stop doing what you're used to doing. Only because we're used to it, not because it's a good. Okay. All right, so maybe we should wrap it up here. It's getting late. And so again, so we'll, for next Sunday, we'll hold off, but I'll touch base regarding, email if I see we have time and maybe we could do something over the next week. But as for now, next Sunday, we're going to postpone and we'll continue the following Sunday. All right, so I think that's the 13th.
All right.
All right. All right, and I'll see you and Carol and Joshua in Phoenix in a couple of days.
All right, thanks.
Okay,
good traveling to seeing everybody. Yep.
All right,
us too.
All right, everybody have a good week. Jim, Rivka, everybody have a good week. I'll put both the glasses online, last week's and this week's, so I'll take care of that within the hour. All right, be well, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.